It's 7:44 on this West Virginia morning. I'm Teresa Wills. This time of the year in many cities and towns throughout Appalachia, there's usually one large chimney that becomes the focus of a massive cloud of spiraling birds aptly called chimney swifts.
They need the right kind of chimney to go into. It's got to have something that they can grab a hold of.
We'll learn more about these fast flyers in just a moment. This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. Retired coal miners and coal community activists are in Washington, D.C. this week urging action on two important issues for miners, pension and black lung benefits. Becca Schimmel reports.
Advocates say funds supporting both pensions for retired miners and the federal benefits for those sickened by black lung disease are at risk if Congress doesn't act. On pensions, a United Mine Workers spokesperson says the miners' pension fund could become insolvent by 2022. That, in turn, could overwhelm the Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. Congress created a joint select committee to shore up multi-employer pension funds that are in jeopardy, but the UMWA's Phil Smith is concerned about the progress the committee is making.
You know, they've had a few meetings and they've had a few hearings, but they really didn't hear much from workers.
Retired Kentucky coal miner Larry Miller is also skeptical about whether the committee will find a solution to the miners' pensions. Miller mined coal for more than 20 years and is on Capitol Hill this week talking to lawmakers. He's also concerned about the Black Lung Disability Trust Fund. It's supported by a tax paid by coal companies, which is set to be reduced unless Congress intervenes. It's a personal issue for Miller, who's been diagnosed with stage one of black lung.
And the doctors say it. You know, you could live like this the rest of your life and not see any lung function impairment, or you could start to go down the mall.
The Ohio Valley has seen a surge in cases of black lung, which likely means more demand for benefits from the trust fund, which is already in debt. Miller says coal miners who developed black lung rely on those benefits and their pensions to live because they can't work and support themselves due to their illness.
Based on our retirement, on Social Security, and this pension. If we lose one leg of that retirement, which is pensions, we're going to be looking at some tough financial decisions.
Miller says a lot of coal field communities have lost jobs because of coal company bankruptcies, and without pension benefits, those economies will suffer. The Joint Select Committee has to present its recommendations for shoring up multi-employer pensions by November 30th. The tax supporting the Black Lung Trust Fund will expire at the end of the year unless Congress acts to keep it in place. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
Right before the sun goes down in Appalachia this time of the year, there's usually a spectacle in the sky somewhere in each city or town that might be worth looking up at. The Allegheny Front's Kara Holsoppel reports from Pittsburgh.
Recently, a group of Swift fans gathered outside of a Pittsburgh restaurant in anticipation. But these Swifties aren't here for a pop concert or a celebrity sighting. They've gathered together along a side street to witness a natural phenomenon that happens around dusk this time of year, the roosting of chimney swifts.
The square one?
The square one. Although there are two chimneys there, so I think we should keep our eye on both of them. If you go,
Sarah Koenig is conservation director for Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania, and she's looking up at the chimneys on an old church in Pittsburgh that's been converted to a restaurant. It's noisy here with nearby traffic, the restaurant's exhaust fan, kids practicing football in an adjacent field, but 50 people have their eyes peeled for the little cigar-shaped birds that are just starting to arrive.
I love just kind of seeing them come out of nowhere. It's like, oh, here comes another one, joining the big group.
Koenig says chimney swifts spend their summers in eastern North America breeding and their winters in the upper Amazon. They're regrouping now to migrate south.
They're like the ultimate urban insectivore because they eat 3,000 to 5,000 insects per day. So they eat mosquitoes and, you know, other biting things that might annoy us.
She says the little birds spend the whole day on the wing, cruising around for insects and even mating in the air. Their tiny short feet can't perch, so the birds have to cling to rough surfaces like the inside of a chimney.
They need the right kind of chimney to go into. It's got to have something that they can grab a hold of. Now there's a lot of chimneys that have steel or aluminum flues, and most of us either have a cap on our chimney or we have the wrong kind of chimney.
Joan Schoaf has been birding for 60 years, but she's never seen swifts go down into a chimney to sleep for the night. Chimney swifts used to roost in hollowed out trees, but development pushed them to adapt in the city and suburbs. Now they're common in communities with old brick chimneys, but they're near threatened as pesticides reduce their food sources, and even more development means chimneys are becoming a thing of the past.
They chitter like crazy.
Oh, I do. I hear them.
Yeah. It's neat.
Dozens of birds are now swirling around the chimney. It's a dramatic sight against the dark clouds, and they're fast. People have stopped using their binoculars to see them because the individual birds are so hard to keep in their sights. The streetlights are on too, and we're all shielding our eyes.
It's like watching smoke go back down a chimney. It's amazing.
Rob Potts is an experienced birder who monitors peregrine falcons. He's seen this spectacle before, but he's just as excited as everyone else here.
A couple went down. There's going. There they go. There they go. There they go. There they go.
That was awesome. Right? Wasn't that cool? Is this your first time?
Yeah.
All right, that was amazing.
Eric Blondin is new to all of this. He says he just started dating a serious birder.
I couldn't find my keys the other day. For an hour, I was looking for my keys. And then I'm sitting here and these birds migrate thousands of miles to the same chimney, and I couldn't find my keys. Like, right? I don't know, something like this makes me feel small. Just kind of in awe of bigger things than me.
The chimney swifts will leave the roost in the morning, and they'll leave the area for South America in October. I'm Carol Holsapple.
This year's Appalachian Heritage Writer in Residence at Shepherd University is Karen Spears Zacharias. Zacharias grew up in a military family, but spent most of her childhood in the hills of Appalachia. During the Vietnam War, her father was killed in action, and his death left a major impact on Zacharias' life and the lives of her mother and siblings. Liz McCormick sat down with Zacharias to hear how writing and faith helped her through the struggles of her youth. Here's an excerpt from that interview.
I was 9 when Dad was killed in the Vietnam War, which was 1966. So that was really early on into that conflict. And prior to my dad's death, everything in our life revolved around my dad. Where we would live, what schools we would go to, where our next deployment would be. Everything was centered around my father. And when my father died, there fell this great silence over the household, where each of us in our own grief, my brother who was 12, my sister who was 7, and my mom, who was 30, we each retreated to our own corners. And so the man who had been the center of our life for all those previous years, now we didn't even speak his name. Once he was buried, we didn't tell stories about him. There was nothing ever spoken. I think it wasn't until I was grown and began writing, and by that time I was in my late 40s, that we ever spoke my father's name again. The only person in my life when I was growing up that would tell me stories about my dad was his mother. And I think it's because she shared that ongoing grief. And speaking the name of her child, which was my dad, or telling stories about my dad, kept him alive for her, and certainly did for me.
Why didn't you all talk about him?
Well, I think, you know, certainly this was a different generation, different time period, and people did not talk about unpleasant things. I lived in the South. It was not okay to talk about the unpleasant things of life. And certainly the South was going through its own growing pains during the 60s and early 70s and having to confront some of its own history in those areas. But it wasn't just our family. This was a culture-wide situation. You have to keep in mind that Vietnam, that particular war, was the first one that was ever televised. It was the first one where a child could lose a parent in war and then get a TV dinner and sit down in front of the TV at night and see bodies being carried off the battlefield. That was a huge impact, and we were living in the midst of that. But in my schools, there was no mention of the war. There was never any discussions in any class that I ever had about the conflict and the war that was going on, and whether it was important or not, or whether it was moral or not. There was never any of that because we did not talk about unpleasant things.
So how did writing allow you to process through all of that?
The things a child doesn't speak about are usually the things that they felt guilty about or ashamed of. So for me, throughout my childhood and into my early adulthood, I would meet people who would ask, you know, about my family, and I would mention that my father had been killed in Vietnam. And more often than not, the typical reply was, "What a waste." Well, if you tell a child that their parent's life or their parent's death was a waste, that child will assume that guilt and assume that shame. And when I turned 30, I was a mother by that point. I was also very aware of that this is the age my mother was when her world fell apart. And I began to write about that, about what that felt like to witness that as a child. And writing gave me an order to all that chaos. I could have control over something that had controlled me for so long.
Of course, I understand that, you know, religion and faith, they play a major role in your novel, Mother of Rain. And also it plays a big part in your life. Do you think that there's a strong connection between religion and what makes someone Appalachian, whether that's through worship of like the Christian God or a great spirit or creator, as your character Bertie Luttrell mentions several times in your novel?
So for me, during that really chaotic time of my life, the church became the safe place. School was not a safe place because I happened to attend high school during the years of federal busing and the chaos of the civil rights movement. Home was not a safe place. My mother's life spiraled out of control. So what happened with me is that it was the church that provided that place of community, which is really the story of Mother of Rain. It is about how community can be that place of healing. So the church in Appalachia has been a place of community. And in that community, people who are hurting have been able to find hope. And as our culture, both in Appalachia and nationwide, has changed, the church is no longer often that place of hope or that place of healing. And so people have turned to things like opioids, because hurting people will always seek solace. It's a matter of who's going to be there to offer it to them.
That was author Karen Spears Zacharias speaking with Liz McCormick. Zacharias is the 2018 Appalachian Heritage Writer in Residence at Shepherd University. Her work is being celebrated all this week. Her novel, Mother of Rain, is this year's One Book, One West Virginia Common Reading Selection. To hear a longer version of this interview, visit our website at wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. Our producer is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.